You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, a lot going on. Ecuador says, you guys are just, you know, they said, well, it might take, you know, a couple days to process Ed Snowden's papers, or, you know, in the case of Julian Assange, it took us 2 weeks. And so the newspapers are reporting that Ed Snowden is going to sleep at the Moscow airport for 2 weeks. I still have doubts about whether he's even there. Nobody saw him get on the plane in Hong Kong. No one saw him on the plane from Hong Kong to Moscow. Not one person has come forward. I mean, somebody would love to get the media spotlight, right? Or the you know, get paid for the National Enquirer. I mean, there's a lot of publications that will pay for stories like this. To get some money for saying, yeah, I sat next to this guy. Now that I've seen his picture, sure, that's the guy I sat next to in the airplane. Or that's the guy I passed going to the bathroom. Whatever. Nobody saw him on the airplane. Nobody saw him in the airport in Moscow at all, anywhere. There has not been one single published picture and not one single published report from anybody who says, yes, I saw him. Increasingly, I'm thinking that Vladimir Putin is having the last laugh, going, oh, yeah, maybe he's in the airport, yeah, or he is in the airport. That's, come on. I mean, the guy used to run a spy agency, you know, to deflect public, you know, confuse people. It's very good at that, you would think. I'm wondering, I mean, there was that Icelandic billionaire who had his private jet there in Hong Kong. I'm wondering if Snowden worked something out and they hopped on the plane and he's been sitting in a cabana in Ecuador or, you know, on a beach someplace for the last week, just, you know, sipping Mai Tais. Who knows? Anyhow, there's that. In New York, paid sick leave just became the law, thanks to Michael Bloomberg. We will be debating that in the next hour with Scotty Nell Hughes of the Tea Party News Network. Debbie Hines is going to drop by in our third hour. Some interesting, I was over at the TV studios before, I do that before I come here to set up the TV show tonight. And, you know, we got all the networks on the wall. And some interesting testimony from this woman who was a friend of Trayvon Martin's and was talking to him at the time that George Zimmerman attacked him. And particularly interesting how George Zimmerman's lawyer tried to take her apart. So we'll check in with Debbie Hines on that and find out. That'll be in our third hour today. And robotic pigeon pranksters taking over Tokyo? I'll tell you about that, too. So a lot going on. But in the 48 hours since the Supreme Court gutted Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, I think this is probably the biggest news. Six of the nine states that have been subject to the law's preclearance formula have already taken steps to restrict voting. In Texas, just 2 hours after Tuesday's Supreme Court decision came down, Attorney General issued a statement saying that Texas voter ID laws and gerrymandering plans could go into effect immediately. And similar actions are being taken in Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, South Carolina, and Virginia to gerrymander and to suppress the vote. But this war against voters didn't begin on Tuesday, or last week, or last month, or even last year. The war against voters started in 1980 when Ronald Reagan, or 81, when Ronald Reagan took over the presidency. In fact, it started in 1980 before he even stepped foot inside the White House. Reagan's first speech during his campaign for the presidency took place in Neshoba County Fair in Neshoba County, Mississippi, Philadelphia, Mississippi, which at that time was a white supremacist stronghold. Reagan's campaign chose that event and that area for his first campaign speech to get racist votes. Why would you say there, racist votes? Well, Neshoba County was that. This was where three civil rights activists were murdered in 1964. They made a movie about it. They were shot to death by racists who were enraged by the idea of African Americans having not only equal rights, but the right to vote. To vote. During his presidency, Reagan opposed the Voting Rights Act of 1965 openly. In fact, he said that the Voting Rights Act was, quote, humiliating to the South, end quote. In the years since Reagan took office And since the Reagan Revolution has spread across America, pretty much everybody in the United States is, not pretty much everybody, but a large chunk of this country, particularly the so-called Republicans and moderates or independents, have taken the position that, you know, everybody shouldn't have a voice in our democracy. And, you know, America ain't all that great. I mean, we hate our government, right? How can you have a great country if you've got a lousy government? The fundamental assumption of Reaganomics is that America is bad. Government is not the solution to your problems. Government is the problem. Government is bad. America is bad. That's the founding core principle of Reaganomics and Tea Partynomics. And besides losing faith in the very foundations of our nation, consider some of the other things that America's lost since the not-so-good old days of Reagan. To start with, we've lost our ability to keep corporations in check, to prevent them from stealing millions from the working class. Thanks to Reagan, corporate theft and illegal behaviors have skyrocketed because he did away with government oversight and regulation of corporate America. As a result, since the Reagan Revolution, corporations have run roughshod over our economy and our democracy. Reagan's policies led to one of the greatest financial scandals in American history, the savings and loan debacle, which cost taxpayers billions of dollars and set the stage for weak banking regulations of today. And if people like Senator Phil Graham, following Reagan's philosophies, hadn't done away with regulation oversight of America's big banks, the financial scandals that have taken place over the last decade would never have happened. Meanwhile, as Reagan was helping out corporate America, he was waging an all-out war on labor in America. His attacks on organized labor in America and the NLRB drove down employee wages. His all-out assault on labor and his staunch opposition to the minimum wage led to three decades of flat wages while CEO and executive pay went through the roof. Between 1983 and 1988, Reagan's policies led to 10 million Americans losing their jobs through an epidemic of plant closings and layoffs. And of those 10 million who lost their jobs, many were forced to take lower-paying jobs. The middle class began to crumble during the Reagan presidency. Under Reagan, the number of families living below the poverty line exploded by a third. And these same families were then hit by Reagan's cuts to social welfare programs like Medicaid and food stamps. Oh, and let us not forget, ketchup is a vegetable for school lunches. Since Reagan took office, the share of total before-tax income flowing to the top 1% of Americans has doubled. The destruction of our economy since Reagan took office is largely thanks to his failed theory of trickle-down economics, which has over and over and over again been debunked. I just spent a half hour with Ralph Nader. You can see it on TV next Friday, a week from Friday. And he's just like, yeah, that's where it all began. Since Reagan was so obsessed with this notion, actually, he says, you know, a lot of it also began in the 70s with the Powell memo. Since Reagan was so obsessed with this notion, he did nothing to reduce the levels of poverty and the growing income gap in America. But a strong economy and government oversight of corporate America are not the only things we've lost since Reagan stepped foot inside the White House. We've lost trust in our government. After all, the Reagan administration was one of the most corrupt in American history, including, by one estimate, 31 Reagan-era convictions, including 14 convictions in the Iran-Contra affair and 16 in the Department of Housing and Urban Development scandal. Over 183 appointees of the Reagan administration either resigned under an ethical cloud or were indicted criminally. Reaganomics continues to devastate this nation, and Reagan's philosophy that America is bad, that our government has no value, that our government is the problem, not the solution, continues to damage our body politic.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time for us to say, you know, Reaganomics, stupid mistake. Reagan worldview, stupid mistake. So what else did Reagan do? This is incredible. In the early 1980s, you know, they had he rebooted Social Security. It was one of the things that you could argue he did well, although I would say he did it wrong, because he doubled the taxes on working people, literally doubled the Social Security tax on working people, and put a cap on it that was inflation adjusted, but the cap at that time was around $40,000 a year of maximum amount of income. And after that, you didn't have to pay Social Security tax. So the upper middle class and very wealthy people pay, you know, virtually nothing. I mean, very extremely wealthy people, you know, not even a fragment of a percent of their income into Social Security. Whereas all of the income of working people now up to $118,000 a year is taxed for Social Security at a rate that was twice what it was before Reagan came into office. So he doubled the tax on working people and cut, of course, by almost two-thirds the income tax on really rich people. But, see, that still didn't solve Social Security's problem, and so he went to the Social Security administrators and said, come up with a way to cut the costs to Social Security. Well, Social Security at that time, you know, Social Security, well, not just at that time, even today, not only provides a buffer for people in retirement, people over 65, it's poverty insurance, basically. But that's two-thirds of what Social Security does. A third of what Social Security does is it provides for widows, orphans, and disabled people. I mean, quite literally, widows, orphans, and disabled people. When Paul Ryan's dad died, his mom was able to get Social Security, although they were very rich and they didn't need it. He likes to brag about the fact that they got it, as if they lived off it, in any case. So they were like, okay, you know, we doubled the tax on working people, but that wasn't quite enough to fix Social Security, so what do we do? So Reagan directed the Social Security Administration people to look at ways they could cut Social Security disability. And they said, well, you know, nobody seems to care about mental health. Why don't we cut that? And so they came up with a whole new definition of mental health, and they took the money for mental health and turned it into block grants for the states. And the result of that was that all across the country, mental health facilities that were housing people who were not able to function on their own closed their doors, and those people showed up on our streets, and many of them today go by, you know, we know them as homeless people. Now, there's a second population of homeless people that we've had since Reaganomics, and that's what used to be middle-class people who just can't get a job and they've lost their homes. But back in the 80s, we still had an FDR economy. You know, the economy was still pretty solid. We were living in the era of the New Deal, which was from 1933 to 1981. And in that era of the New Deal, we pretty much didn't have homelessness. But, you know, so Reagan brought us that. So from devastating our economy to gutting social welfare programs, sending millions of people, thousands of Americans onto the streets, to devastating our image all around the world. I mean, you know, we attacked Nicaragua after, you know, Reagan did after Congress passed a law saying that he couldn't. He was selling weapons to Iran after, you know, it seemed like we thought Iran was not our friend. The damage this guy has done to our country is incredible. Bob in Fontana, California, you don't understand?
I'm just, like I said, I just grabbed your program a couple of days ago, and I've been listening. I listen to both sides and try to draw my own conclusion, you know? And
right.
I just try to figure out, like, I hear you always complaining about Reagan. Hey, you know, that's all fine and dandy. I like to hear what you got to say. But a question I have to ask is, if it was so bad, why has all the presidents passed, you know, after him hasn't done anything, including this president?
Well, Clinton tried to roll back Reaganomics slightly, but you know what Reagan did was basically he handed the keys to the government, to the kingdom, over to the fat cats, the banksters, the transnational corporations. And so, you know, Clinton ran, if you go back and read his New Covenant speech from 1992, he ran on a platform of restoring FDR's New Deal. And there have been numerous stories about this, including a major media like the New York Times. About a week before he took office, Alan Greenspan and Jamie Rubin sat him down and said, well, young man, you think you're going to do that, but that's not how the world works anymore. The political parties are now controlled by big money, and you're going to dance to the tune of big money. And so he raised taxes 3 points. You know, he took the top tax rate up by 3 percentage points. And but that wasn't even close. I mean, Reagan had dropped it from 74% down to 28%. Clinton took it from 36 up to 39%. It was nothing. So I would say that Clinton didn't do it because, frankly, I don't think that he had the power or the courage to do it. And Obama hasn't done it, I think, in part because he doesn't have the power or the courage to do it, and in larger part because everything Obama has tried to do has been opposed by a relatively small but very powerful cabal of Republicans who met the night that Obama was inaugurated at the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C. It's well documented. Afterwards, one of them said, we are going to follow the Taliban. We're going to do an insurgency. We're going to make sure that the Obama presidency is a complete and utter failure. We will not allow him to have any successes. And other than an 11-week window before Scott Brown got sworn in, an 11-week window in the history of the United States Senate, where Obama had a veto or a filibuster-proof majority. Other than that, the Republicans have filibustered everything he's tried. I mean, Nancy Pelosi passed over 300 pieces of good legislation out of the House, including one that would have stopped the practice of outsourcing our jobs, would have stopped tax breaks for companies like, you know, Mitt Romney's company that shut down that factory, Sensata, in Ohio or Illinois, wherever it was, and shipped it brick by brick over to China. They got a tax break for doing that. They got paid by our government for doing that. And Pelosi reversed that and said, in fact, we're going to give a tax break to those companies that have moved overseas that bring their factories back to the United States. And what happened? It went to the Senate, and Republicans filibustered it. It was the best thing for America. It was the best thing for working people. It was the major reversal of Reaganomics. Republicans blocked it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So I stand behind what I said. I stand on this ground. If we want America to come to once again be a functioning country, we need to roll back Reaganomics. Well, Rick Perry really stepped in it after Wendy Davis, the state senator, who filibustered the attempts of the Republicans to shut down most of the abortion clinics in the state and restrict a woman's right to get an abortion in that state beyond what was defined by Roe v. Wade. His response to her was to say she was a teenage mom and she's the child of a single parent. Her mother was a single parent, was a single parent child. Or she was the child of a single parent, and she was a teenage mom. Right. So Wendy Davis, in fact, here's what Rick Perry said. In fact, even the woman who filibustered the Senate the other day was born in a difficult circumstances. She was the daughter of a single woman. She was a teenage mother herself. She managed to eventually graduate from Harvard Law School and serve in the Texas Senate. Oh, gee, you think? Senator Wendy Davis responds, saying, Rick Perry's statement is without dignity and tarnishes the high office he holds. They are small words that reflect a dark and negative point of view. Our governor should reflect our Texas values. Sadly, Governor Perry fails that test. Good on you, Wendy Davis. Wendy Davis has become a national rock star. I think it's fascinating. It's just fascinating. James in Englewood, Colorado, listening on AM 760 in Denver. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, how you doing?
Hi.
I listen to your show all the time. This is the first time I've actually called in.
Mm-hmm.
So you were talking about the early 80s and how, Reaganomics was dumping mentally ill people onto the street. And I have to say, I wasn't mentally ill, but I was one of those persons that was dumped onto the streets. In 1983, I was a foster child in Los Angeles County Child Protection Services,
mm-hmm.
McLaren Hall, to be exact. And once they began losing funding, they began just busing children by the dozens and just depositing them throughout Los Angeles County onto the streets.
Really?
It's just amazing. Oh, yeah. It's absolutely amazing.
And you were one of them.
My life I will never forget.
How old were you?
I was 16.
And you just got dumped on the street. Good luck, kid. Have fun.
Well, no. I mean, they gave us If you were lucky enough to have a relative to go to, an aunt, an uncle, a brother, a sister, they would take you there.
Sure.
I was very unfortunate in the sense that I only had had a father before I was put in foster care.
Right.
And he passed away December 25th, 1981. And, yeah, Christmas Eve. And from 1981 to 1983, I was in an institution called McLaren Hall.
Right.
And once they had, run out of funding, run out of money, or run out of empathy, whatever you wanted to call it, they gave you $10, a set of clothes, and, where do you want to go?
Wow.
And
where'd you go?
Just right there. I went to a city. I picked a city on a map, actually. I think it was called Downey. At the age of 16, I began stealing just to support myself.
That's
and
incredible.
Wound up in juvenile hall. And I mean, it's just, a mess.
Yeah.
I mean, fortunately I was able to, pull myself out of that. Those were really dark, horrible times.
Yeah.
For people that didn't have a family or didn't have a means.
Yeah. For anybody in need.
It's real.
Yeah.
It was real. It was real.
Yeah.
And anytime anybody says that, that type of stuff did not happen, bull crap. It happened.
Yeah.
It happened.
Yeah. So, James, thank you for sharing your story with us. And good on you for climbing out of it. Was there an additional point you wanted to make, or was that pretty much it?
No. That's it. I think I've
you've said it.
I think I've shot my fire.
Okay. James, thanks a lot for the call. That was brilliant. That's a keeper. Lewis in Woodbury, New Jersey. Hey, Lewis.
Mr. Tom Hartman.
That's me.
Thank you for taking my call, sir.
You're welcome.
I am listening. I'm listening to you almost 2 years now. I'm 5 days on the road, 5 days a week on the road, and I have to admit that you are a source of information and very educational, sir.
Well, thank you.
When I open that television or radio, I'm looking for four characteristics: information, knowledge, passion, and a code of honor. And you possess all of those characteristics, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Are you saying all these nice things because you're going to whack me upside the head here next?
No, I'm not.
So what's on your mind, Lewis?
You're not going to find those on corporate media, special Fox News, but let me proceed with the with my point, my comment. Yesterday, at the beginning of your show, you had a gentleman expressing the argument from Justice Scalia.
Yeah.
Referring to DOMA, the Supreme, and I'm paraphrasing, the Supreme Court strikeout.
Yeah.
Claiming unconstitutional, and the federal government shall not have the right to discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
His argument was, if a same-sex married couple moves from one state to another, which the laws are different, what will be the position of the Internal Revenue Service and which state laws will enforce?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to me, it seems clear. I will argue that the Internal Revenue Service should not be obligated to comply with any state laws, and on the federal level, the Internal Revenue Service representing the federal government, collecting federal taxes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And in fact, if somebody gets married in Mexico or in Canada or in England, and whether it's a gay couple or a straight couple, the IRS doesn't say, we're not going to consider you married because of where you were married.
Exactly.
I agree with you. Yes.
On the other hand, the states, they can implement their own laws collecting taxes, for instance, which the most important issue is the federal taxes and benefits.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you agree with me, because I value your opinion very much.
Thank you
for the opportunity to talk.
Certainly.
To you.
Certainly. Thank you for the call. Very nice to hear from you. Christopher in Ocean Park, Washington. Hey, Christopher, what's up?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about the Supreme Court striking down Section 4. Why couldn't Congress just say, okay, then it's going to apply to all 50 states and not have it be discriminatory against any?
in other words, people, gay people have the right to be married in any state. The
no,
Supreme
I'm
Court,
talking about the Voting Rights Act.
Oh, the Voting Rights Act. Oh, okay.
They just said,
Section
why don't
four,
we
right.
make Section 4 apply to all 50 states?
Right. They, in other words, they could have inverted their logic. They could have said, times have changed, but racism is still with us. So henceforth now and forever, world without end, amen, instead of only applying to those states where we used to have problems with racism, now we're detecting problems with racism in other states as well. And so we're going to say that we're going to strike down Section 4. We're going to essentially rewrite Section 4, which the court has asserted its ability to do. By rewriting Section 4, we're essentially going to say all states have to preclear any changes. You know, I think, Christopher, you make an excellent point, and I think that it's something that the court could have, and I would argue should have done, because now you've got states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana and Ohio that have been, and Pennsylvania, that have been taken over by right-wing Republicans, even though they're blue states. But, you know, by pouring enormous amounts of money into them to use them as incubators, as test sites for other states, a small handful of billionaires have basically taken over these states and they're trying out stuff. I mean, you know, the DeVos family pouring money into the Republican Party in Michigan, and then the emergency manager laws. Let's see what happens if we just do away with democracy in Detroit. And, you know, these are all incubator tests. And the Supreme Court should have looked at those and said, you know, this is even worse than it was in the 60s in some ways. Now, in the decision, they point out people aren't being murdered anymore. I would disagree, frankly. I would say that we are. And in fact, now we have state executions. Most people on death row are black, but and yet most people in our country are not. So, you know, I'd say we're still racism is alive and well, and in many ways even worse, arguably. But that said, it's also institutionalized. As Joe Madison said in this program a couple of days ago, it's not Jim Crow anymore. It's James Crow, ESQ. So excellent point, Christopher. Thanks for calling and making it. Harry in Seattle. Hey, Carrie. Hey, Harry.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Hope your arm gets better soon.
Thank you.
Do you think if you were to go to the Reagan Library that there would be any reference to the fact that his agents before the election went behind the backs of the Carter administration and had dealings with the Iranians, which is contrary to the law, and told them that they would be able to get parts for military aircraft if they would just not release the hostages until Jimmy Carter had left office.
Right, as attested to by the president of Iran, Mr. Bani Sadr himself, who wrote about this, the Christian Science Monitor, just 4 or 5 weeks ago. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. And I guarantee you that will not be in the Reagan Library, that Reagan committed treason. And it should be. It should be the sign that hangs on the front door. Harry, thanks for the call. Right, literally. Make a sign for the front door. Read Barbara Honegger's book, October Surprise. Here it is. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Reaganomics. To paraphrase Nancy, just say no. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Andre Butler is on the line with us, a banquet server, part of the camp out at the Pennsylvania Capitol in support of expanded Medicaid coverage. And Andre, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. Glad to be here.
So tell us who you are and what you're doing right now.
Right now I'm sitting in the Capitol of Pennsylvania in Harrisburg on the Senate side, sitting on a beautifully shined marble floor, exercising my free speech rights, and camped out asking and hoping that the governor of Pennsylvania and or the Senate and House of Pennsylvania will allow the Medicaid expansion for 750,000 uninsured Pennsylvanians, including myself.
And how many people have joined you?
So far, we have about 15.
That's great. That's a start.
It is. It's actually beautiful to see. We're from all corners of the state have all come.
Mm-hmm.
Erie, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, Scranton, Souderton, and it's just it's it's great to be a part of history. It's never been done in this particular capital. No one's ever decided to sit in or sleep in here, which gives me an idea of how radical this particular, you know, governor is, even against, even in his own party, how unfriendly he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate he has to come to this. You know, we shouldn't have to forego our jobs or our families and friends to have a camp out for a simple common sense issue. I mean, it's a human right. Health insurance is a human right. And how much money governments would save if they would just insure the uninsured and give us health insurance to prevent illnesses.
Yeah. Now, is my memory not failing me in that my recollection is that your governor is Republican Tom Corbett. Is that right?
Correct. Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Okay. And so he is apparently one of the Republican governors who has either said he's not going to take the funding for Medicaid to pay for Obamacare or to expand Obamacare to poor people and the working poor, or he's one of the governors who has not yet said either he said no or he said I don't know. Which is it, right, so far?
He said he doesn't recommend that we accept it.
So that's kind of a weaselly way to, you know. So he's
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely. And his reason is he's not sure that we can afford the 1 to 10% after 3 years.
Right.
That's right.
We're gonna get 100% of the money now, and 3 years down the road, we're gonna get 97% of the money, and we're going to insure hundreds of thousands of people in our state who are you know the very poor and the working poor, and who, if we don't do this, if we don't provide this insurance for them, we're still going to have to pay when they show up in the emergency rooms with far worse conditions. You know, when what could have been an early caught and treated cancer turns into a horrible person melting down wound or something, and or whatever it may be. You know, when a cough turns out to be tuberculosis, that we can't afford the 3%. This is crazy. So has Tom Corbett responded in any way, Andre Butler?
No, he has not.
Okay. Now, are you associated with any group, or is this just an ad hoc bunch of citizens who have shown up?
This was an ad hoc group of concerned citizens who just had enough and felt the issue was passionate enough, you know, that we need to do something to actually take a stand. You know, there was a song, if you may recall, Brooke Benton did a song a few years back, and it's a right thing called I'm a Man. Mm-hmm. And he said in his song, why must I fight for what I have won?
Right.
And it took us years to get the Affordable Care Act, you know, still in Obamacare, and that's what we have. It's law, and it's law. It was passed by the Supreme, you know, by the Supreme, Court, upheld it. And so we already have that right. Now, if we don't insure the uninsured, what good is having health care?
Yeah.
And so we just bring it with time. It's a stand. The budget has to be passed by law by the 30th of June. Now, it may go past the time he said it may be passed by the for you, they go this round the clock sessions now. It's about to pass the budget. We knew this was our critical time to try to take a stand and have our voices heard by, you know, uninsured people.
That's great. So if any of our listeners happen to be in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area, drop by the Capitol building and show up?
After Capitol building, come to the Senate side, floor E.
Okay.
E as in Edward.
Okay. You got it.
We would love to have them. We have food, snacks. We sing some songs once in a while. We get together. People come by and visit us. We shake hands. We go about outside the lobby. We lobby with other people, other politicians, and we have a lot of fun.
Are you being treated well by the other politicians, by the politicians there, and by the security people there?
Yes, we are. We are.
That's great.
We were there. The ones that support us come by and they thank us for our support, and we thank them for supporting us. And we've been treated very well. We have no problem with anybody abusing us at all.
That's great. And are you planning on spending the night there?
We should be able to do so. We are in so long as the session is in. The legislation is in session. It's going to go over to the parliament. We expect to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when do you expect that they're going to discuss a consideration of accepting the Medicare money?
We're hearing in the next 48 hours.
Okay. Because it has to be done by the 30th.
Correct.
And today being the 27th, that would be 3 days out, but you know, probably in the next 2 days. And so you guys are in for the long haul.
We are here to get our voices heard, and we want it done. We want it done as soon as we can, and we are here to make our presence felt.
You are doing what the First Amendment talks about, the citizens peaceably assembling and petitioning the government for redress of grievances. It's absolutely brilliant. Andre Butler, you're in the real world. You are a banquet server?
Yes.
And the wages at that are such that you qualify for Medicare.
Absolutely. Most banquet, and for people to realize, you know, when most of the banquets, whether VIP events or high class events or parties, even events that governors go to, most of your people that you see in bow ties and starched shirts and tuxedos that serve, we don't have any kind of health insurance. And the wages are basically between $8 and $11 an hour. It's not really that much of a lucrative job.
Wow.
And when you're servers, bussers, cooks, you know, waiters, hostesses, most of us don't have any kind of health insurance, so we have to serve the 1%.
Amazing.
We just wanted this point.
Andre, we got to wrap it up. But Andre Butler, thank you for being with us. Good on you, sir.
Mr. Hartman, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we just heard from a fellow who was in the Pennsylvania State House, Andre Butler, camping out to say to Tom Corbett, please take that Medicare or Medicaid money. Perhaps more to the point, right now, you know, you and me, all of us taxpayers, subsidize massively large corporations. In fact, the largest corporation in America, the largest recipient, the largest single recipient of our welfare subsidies is Walmart, because they pay their employees so little that their employees qualify for Medicaid and for food stamps. But that said, the city of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, just passed a rule saying, or a law or whatever, however you call it in a city, I guess it's a law, saying that employers have to offer up to 5 paid sick days a year to their employees, which just seems to make sense to me. If I'm eating in a restaurant in New York City, and there's a lot of them, I'd like to know that the guy who brought my food out wasn't sneezing on it all the way out there, because he was afraid that if he didn't take, that if he took a day off, he wouldn't be paid, and he was paid so poorly that he wouldn't be able to live if he took the day off, or he might lose his job. Scotty Nell Hughes is on the line with us, the news director and contributor to the Tea Party News Network, the website tpnn.com. And Scotty, do I understand that you actually think that employers shouldn't have to pay at least 5 paid sick days a year?
Listen, Tom, here's the deal. If we were in a wonderful economy where things were sitting here and thriving and money was growing on trees.
You mean like the stock market was hitting all-time highs and corporate profits were higher than they'd ever been in the history of the country? Which we are right now, by the way.
Oh, they are. So that's great. I mean, so our economy is actually, you know, everybody's got money and everybody's got a job.
At least from the point of view of the employers and the rich people. Yes. Yes. They're doing very well right now.
Well, but usually rich people have to hire people to work for them. So if they have so much money, then why are there so many people unemployed?
Because they're not hiring people.
Oh, they're just keeping the money themselves.
They are. They're putting it in Swiss bank accounts. They're putting it in the Grand Caymans. They're using it to buy a new yacht. But, yeah, and the yachts, by and large, are not made here. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, this is where you and I definitely have a differential, because I believe that what we have done in this country is we have attacked the small businessman, the man that is sitting there and trying to survive and trying to be able to hire people.
I am a small businessman. I don't feel under attack.
Well, how many people do you employ?
In aggregate, probably 13.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. You don't feel like you're under attack in any way with taxes?
No.
Obamacare?
I am honored to pay my taxes. It's the cost of the infrastructure that I nakedly exploit, for this program. I mean, my employees all, to the best of my knowledge, all of them were educated in our public schools, and they bring that education to work. I don't have to teach them how to read or write. But the people who work with me, come here by some of them by public transportation, some of them using public streets in their own cars. I'm pleased to pay for all that stuff. We're broadcast over the airwaves that are part of the public domain. Taxes are the cost of admission to a civil society, and the amount of taxes that I'm paying are not so great that we can't run this business. And in fact, I've been running businesses since 1972, and when taxes were a hell of a lot higher, when the top tax rate in 1972 was 74%. And I've never, ever experienced, and in fact, I was making so much money in the mid-70s that my CPA came to me and said, you've got to stop taking so much money as pay and keep it in your small business. And so we developed a whole brand new line of products as a result of this, because you're starting to pass the 40% tax threshold, and it's crazy to pay that much money to the government in taxes. So I dialed back my own salary and put the money into the company. That's how it used to work, Scotty.
Well, it did, and then that's when we had, you know, obviously a thriving economy. But here's the thing, and I'm happy for you. I am thrilled for you, Tom, and it's because I think you have a good product that people enjoy and people listen to and find a use for. But tell me this, Tom. How many people do you know in our industry, in the radio industry, that has gone out of business this past year? I can name five off the top of my head that are no longer doing talk radio because they couldn't afford to do it.
Hmm.
And that's the issue that we're sitting here talking about.
Yeah, I don't
about.
Know anybody who's gone out. And I doubt those five went out of business because they were being taxed. Because if you're about to go out of business, you're making so little money that you're paying no taxes.
Well, but that's the thing. The majority, you have to admit, radio has downsized a lot.
Sure.
Over the last 10 years. Okay.
Largely as a result of vertical integration and consolidation. Yes, I will admit that.
And like I said, if we were in a perfect world, yes, I would love for employers to be able to pay for everything. Unfortunately, when you were talking back in the 70s and the 80s when you did start your companies, did the government tell you, you must buy health insurance for your employees or you're going to be charged a fee? You're going to be charged a penalty fee?
No, they didn't, but I always bought the health insurance. In fact, I remember in the 70s that the Blue Cross Blue Shield health insurance policies in Michigan that we were providing to our employees cost us less than $40 a month and per employee. I remember that quite clearly. I hope I'm not wrong, but I'm quite sure that that was it. But that was because Michigan law in the 1970s was that the health insurance company itself had to be not for profit, and they were, and that the hospitals had to be not for profit, and they were. And so you didn't have things like Stephen J. Hemsley right now, the CEO of United Healthcare, who has taken over $1 billion out of his company and added it to his own personal wealth. Or his predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, who, you know, over a decade took $1.7 billion out of United Healthcare. These guys are getting rich off us, Scotty, and they're using the profit motive to do it, because they've got us against the wall. It's wrong. But that's not my point. My point is, do you really want the server who's bringing the food to you in the restaurant to be sick?
No, and that's where it sits there, and you sit there and you hope that their boss and their management can say, you know what, I don't want you sick. I can't necessarily. I'm trying to make sure that this restaurant stays open so you can have a job when you are healthy. So to sit there and say that you must stay for five additional days, honestly, Tom, this is, in my opinion, just another version of entitlement that the government's imposing on the private sector, saying, nope, yeah, they deserve five. They must have 5 days off. And you know what? At this point, there are people, when we have our welfare system, we have the unemployment numbers so high, people who really want to work then would take that job and would take that job without 5 sick days. But unfortunately, because in a lot of cases, you're paid more to actually reap the system and work the system and be on welfare than you are to actually go and get a solid day's, you know, honest work pay.
That's not true.
What's their motivation?
It's simply not true that people can make more on welfare than they can make working first.
Oh, no.
Unless you're talking about working 10 hours a week.
Work the system for $40,000. You can make up to $40,000 a year.
Those fantasy numbers that were published in that right wing publication a few months ago that suggested that assumed that that one person was able to be about five or six different people, that they had this disability, that they had that disease, that they had this parent died, that this, I mean, there were all these assumptions that were pretty much impossible for any one individual. Talk to people who are living on welfare. You will find that it is damn hard. It is damn hard. But this, again, I don't want to debate welfare with you. It's like, I don't understand why you would want to work in a workplace where people come to work sick and then the disease spreads around the workplace. This isn't good for business.
But I would rather them, you know, I think they should have the liberty to stay home without losing their job. I think that would make
sense. Well, that's going to have to be enforced by the government.
Well,
are you calling for big government on that?
Discrimination cases, but that's not sitting there telling the small businessman that you must pay for 5 days.
I mean, I've started now when I walk into a restaurant saying, do you pay sick time for your employees, and if they say no, I turn around and walk out. And I'm always talking.
Yes, how long till they go out of business?
No, if they say yes, they're one of the better restaurants in Washington D.C. I can tell you, I've been testing this out. But you walk into the fast food joints, you know, do you pay sick time? No. And you're talking to an employee when they say it, by the way, and right. they're pretty steamed about it too. I think this is just a matter of decency, of common decency. But
We might disagree once again, Tom, but the good news is that we do agree that people do need to be working. And so any incentive that we can do to help that.
Yes, work is good. Scotty Nell Hughes, news director and contributor of the Tea Party News Network, TPNN.com. Thank you, Scotty.
Thank you, Tom.
Always nice talking with you. Have fun there at National Airport. Oh, is it called Reagan?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Unfortunately, she'd already hung up before. She didn't hear me say that. Oh, well. I thought it was cute. Just looking at some of the headlines over at... this is a raw story. Witness responds to suggestion that Trayvon lied before getting shot. That's real retarded, sir. Yep. Drunken Texan kills himself while playing with a gun. Rick Perry, Wendy Davis learned nothing from her own example as a teenage mom. Really? S.E. Cup, it's shockingly pathetic that people consider State Senator Wendy Davis heroic. Really? The whole thing is amazing to me. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you wanted to talk about Reaganomics. You're an economist?
Yeah, Tom. I don't work for a large Wall Street firm, though. They only hire liars disguised as economists.
Okay.
But anyway, first I want to say I had to put my phone on mute while that teabagger was talking so my IQ wouldn't drop.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to make a couple points about Reaganomics.
Right.
Paul Ryan just released a budget 3 months ago that was Reaganomics on steroids.
Yes.
And Lamar Alexander just called for eliminating the minimum wage, which is... Yep. More Reaganomics.
Yep.
But my main point is, can you imagine the depression we'd be in if we actually had 32 years of Republicanomics, if we didn't have Bill Clinton or President Obama to undo a lot of the effects of it?
Or Democrats in the House and Senate holding it back like, you know, the little kid with his finger in the dike in the Dutch stories.
Well, that's what the Republicans are blocking, the progress that we could be making.
Mm.
But if we actually had 32 years of Republicanomics, we'd have more than 50% unemployment, and anyone who still had a job would be making about $2 an hour because there'd be no unions anymore, there'd be no minimum wage. Everyone would have to compete with Mexico and China in their wages. So, I mean, it would just be an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And that, by the way, is the way that they would like it, because then the corporations make even more money. They're trying to, and Paul, thank you for the call. They're trying to take us back to the era that Charles Dickens wrote about. And there's a method to that madness. When Charles Dickens was writing in Victorian era England about what life was like, and he wrote, you know, Christmas Carol and the story of, well, among others, but that's the most well-read, the story with which most people are familiar. The middle class of that time was Marley and Scrooge. I mean, Marley was dead, but it was Scrooge. He was a small business owner. It was such a small business that he only had one employee. And his employee was the working poor, Bob Cratchit, whose son Tiny Tim had no health care. And they were praying for a miracle. And they didn't really even have enough food for Thanksgiving dinner, or Christmas dinner, I guess it was. And they never even addressed the rich in A Christmas Carol. I mean, the rich were like there was such a small slice of the population. They were, the landed gentry. So you had, you know, a 1% rich, 2 or 3% was the middle class, and 97% were the working poor. The middle class were the shop owners and the professionals, the lawyers and doctors and things. And the reason the Republicans want to take us back to that time and do away with the middle class is because the middle class is pesky. The middle class, you know, the middle class says, you know, hey, we're gonna applaud an 11-hour filibuster of a right-wing piece of legislation. The middle class speaks out. The middle class stands up. The middle class says, hell no, we won't go to Vietnam. The middle class says women should have rights. The middle class says African-Americans should have rights. Gays should have rights. The middle class is problematic for the corporatists. By the way, breaking news, the Senate just passed the immigration bill, 68-32. Now, this includes a massive jobs program for Texas and Arizona. They're doubling the number of border guards. So they're going to pour billions of dollars into Texas and Arizona. You're going to see these two states, the Republican governors, suddenly have a revival in their economies, assuming that this thing ever becomes law. And that's probably why the right-wingers from the South are supporting it. But anyhow, Al in Greenville, Rhode Island. Hey, Al, what's up?
How are you, Tom? I would just like to make one comment about gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody seems to be discussing the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution. In other words, to my mind, if you get married legally in Massachusetts and you move to Alabama, you are married.
Right.
Period.
Well, except that the marriage, you're talking about in the 14th Amendment, right?
Yeah. There's a full faith and credit clause in the Constitution that says the state shall give full faith and credit to the laws of the other states.
No, it says, it's in Article 4th. Thank you, Shano.
I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And my other point.
Okay, no state without its consent. Okay, go on with your next point while I'm reading this.
All right. Now, people talk about the minimum wage. The minimum wage, if everybody's got to pay it, it becomes part of the role, and it doesn't really affect the economy in particular. You know, people say it's a hardship for me, it's anti-competitive. Well, if you're paying it and your competitor's paying it, how is it anti-competitive? I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, I personally
Good
don't
point.
Want to live in a country where 15% of the people are permanently down and out. It makes me sad.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's also a public health risk. Here's the full faith and credit. Full faith and credit should be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may, by general law, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effect thereof. I think you may well be right. I don't put myself forward as an expert on Article 4, but I think you may well be right. Al, thank you for the call. And with regard to, I don't want to live in a country where 15% or 40% of the workers are, you know, hitting the poverty line or below the poverty line. I remember the German businessman who was being interviewed on Bloomberg a year or so ago, and the reporter was so horrified that this guy was paying so many taxes, and he said, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I'm not a rich man, but I should say that more often. I think that that's an important point. Who would want to be a rich man in a poor country? Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cindy in Watervliet, Michigan, listening to WCPT.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Cindy.
Yes, I wanted to talk about the Defense of Marriage Act. And
mm-hmm.
I had a question after yesterday's announcement. Why does Supreme Court Justice Anton Scalia support Sharia law? Because homosexual marriage is against Sharia law, and he seems to support Sharia law.
Excellent.
They don't see it that way.
Right.
That's what's funny about that.
This is kind of the right-wing language, you know. It's like whoever you're with, you're with. You know, it's like, interesting. Okay. Cindy, thank you. Thank you. That's a nice meme. Thank you for that. James in Yelma, Washington. Hey, James. Reaganomics?
Yes, good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
I can tell you that in 1980, I was 30 years old. I turned 30 years old. And when I found out that my parents had voted for Reagan, I told them both, don't come crying to me when you end up getting what you asked for.
Mm.
And I just wanted to make the point that it doesn't take an architect to understand that you don't build anything from the roof down.
Right.
You always start the foundation and build up.
Mm-hmm.
Including an economic.
Yeah, that's the craziness of trickle-down economics, a.k.a. Reaganomics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well said, James. Well said.
When Reagan did take over, the job that I had, I got laid off from.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turned right around and hired me back at about $4 an hour less than what I had been making previously.
Right. Because Reagan had stocked the Labor Department with anti-labor people, and so you couldn't make a claim, basically, against an employer during the 8 years of the Reagan administration and have it go anywhere with the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board. Yeah, it was a disaster. And it continues. I mean, it's been a rolling disaster ever since then. James, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. Steve in Vista, California. Steve?
Hey.
Regulation? Deregulation?
You hear me?
Yes, sir. Did you want to talk about deregulation?
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, since it's all so fine that they make all this mess all over our land, mm-hmm. and that they can go ahead and tear up all the rivers and tear up the air, well, go ahead. Let's deregulate it. Let them have their way and just let them have it any old way that they want. But they have to adhere to one thing, that they must live in that area where they're doing business.
Right.
They must eat from those fields. They must drink from those streams. I got the funny feeling that they're not going to feel about the same way about the things that they do then.
I think you're absolutely right, Steve. I think you're absolutely right. And I would love to see a return to some sort of corporate rulemaking that says the corporations have to have a majority of their directors and stockholders in the neighborhood where they do business. Of course, that would require requiring corporations to be regional rather than national or international. But I think that would be a healthy thing for this country. Steve, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Jonathan in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about healthcare, but really a lot of the issues that you've been touching on come back to the basic idea. And with healthcare, the issue, or not healthcare, with sick days, the issue is really just one of externalities. If me as an engineer making, you know, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, I go to McDonald's and I get sick, I'm being paid by my worker paid sick days. That's now become an externality because my employer is the one who's picking up the tab for me having gotten sick because the fast food employer wasn't willing to give their employees days off
right.
to make sure that people weren't getting sick. When you have 500 people getting sick from a single worker working when they were sick,
right.
how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars is that going to cost throughout the economy because all of the workers who get sick and they, as higher paid people in our economy,
mm-hmm.
can command and say, no, I'm not going to work for somebody who won't give me paid sick days. No, we need to make that everybody throughout the whole economy because otherwise you're just shifting the costs from one employer to another, and that's not fair.
Right, and it's also bad economics. I wonder, Jonathan, if we were to have paid sick leave, mandatory paid sick leave nationwide here in the United States, if our flu epidemics would not be as severe or as long-lasting.
No, I would be very, very amazed if we weren't going to be seeing huge, huge savings on healthcare simply because fewer people would get sick because you wouldn't have people in the food and health industry going to work sick.
Or people in, name it. People just coming to work in any business that doesn't have paid sick days just coming to work because they need the money or they're afraid of losing their jobs. And while they're at work, they're sniffling and coughing and handling doorknobs on the way in and out. And it's like, boom, stuff spreads.
Yeah, it's a thing where if you're going to give paid sick leave to anybody, you kind of have to give it to everyone.
Yeah.
Because if you're giving your CEO paid sick days off, but the janitor isn't getting paid sick days off, well, the janitor comes in sick and spreads their flu to the CEO, and now you're paying the CEO to take days off.
Right.
That's not good business sense. It's terrible business sense. It doesn't make money.
No, your logic is impeccable, Jonathan, and very solid. Thank you for calling and sharing that. I like that. Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. Listen to WCPT. Hey, Ashes, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
I had this theory that all the governors in the South, I think they're deliberately signing or passing legislation, also the Senate and Houses down there in the South. They're signing and passing legislation that suppresses the minority more and more so that I think minorities would eventually move out of those states and then they would have a white majority all the time in the South.
I don't think minorities are that mobile, though. People at the bottom of the economic food chain tend not to be mobile. What's happening is you've got minorities who are probably within a generation or two going to be majorities, and you've got Republicans hanging on by their fingernails, you know, trying to just eke another couple election cycles out of it with this voter suppression and hoping that they can crash the economy bad enough and hard enough and change the laws enough, like in Michigan, where you literally don't even have democracy anymore. People in Detroit can't vote for a city council because the city council doesn't do anything. The governor has said, sorry, I'm going to replace you with one of my cronies that I'm going to pay $250,000 a year to, and he's going to take your natural resources, you know, Belle Isle or your river or whatever, and he's going to privatize these things. And we're going to take your schools and give them off to my buddies who are in the private school business and stuff like that. I mean, they're plunderers. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you don't think that they would deliberately pass legislation to suppress minorities or...
They absolutely are passing legislation to suppress minorities, but I don't think the minority response to that is going to be, I'm going to move out of the state. I think the minority response to that is going to be, I'm really PO'd about this, and I am going to show up and vote. And that's what you saw in the re-election of President Obama. It's why the African-American voter rate hit 76% and the white voter rate was 75%. And it was the first time in history that the African-American rate had surpassed the white rate. And in many communities around the United States, and it was an open secret what the Republicans were doing. They were trying to prevent African Americans from voting, and word travels. And I think that ultimately these behaviors by the Republicans to suppress the vote of people based on race is going to backfire on them. It might win them an election or two. It might win them 2014. It might win them 2016. It did help them win 2010. But I think that ultimately it's going to backfire. It's going to kick them in the teeth. Ashes, thank you for the call. We'll see, you know, how this all plays out, of course. I don't have any corner on the truth. All I have is an opinion. Rich in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Rich, thanks for listening to AM760.
Always a pleasure. Awesome show, Tom. Great to talk again. I think you should echo that point every day. I don't want to be a poor man and a rich man in a poor country.
Yeah.
And I would echo the point in Aaron Brockovich Julie Roberts says to the corporate lady at Pacific Gas and Electric, oh, by the way, we had that water flown in special for you, Miss such and such. On to Reagan, and I agree with you, the last call. I think it's going to blow up in their face, Tom. It's their worms, white old racist men, and they're going the way of the passenger pigeon.
Yeah.
And like you said, they're doing everything they can. Short of death, I would say. But another thing Reagan did, we didn't have, as you said, you know, we have an illegal employer problem, and we can thank Reagan for that.
Yep, he stopped enforcing the laws. Yep.
Right, and gave his crony buddies, lots of cheap labor.
Yep.
I'd also say that to another group of homeless there was Vietnam veterans that he kicked out into the streets.
Yep.
And that he didn't say one word about AIDS until 25,000 people had died of the disease.
That's right. That's right. Because it was the gay plague, right? And you're absolutely right. Rich, let us never forget the Reagan legacy. Very well said. Thank you for listening to AM 760. Thanks for the call. We'll be back in just a moment, 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, this is interesting. White House Down in theaters tonight. This was the movie that had a different name a couple of month or two ago. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the magic of Hungary at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Learn more about the Hungary program with the Hungarian Heritage Roots to Revival app and the folk and at folklife.hu. Need to tweak the language in that, make it a little
well, you
more
know, it's
legal.
Actually interesting. It's my favorite thing to do. I was just telling our interns, every year the Folklife Festival, I think, focuses on one state and one country.
Oh, interesting.
And
this is Ellen Ratner, by the
yes,
way. Forgive me for not
and,
introducing
it. And it's all over the mall. It's a great 4th of July thing to do. My other favorite 4th of July thing, just in case anybody's near Washington, is at 9 o'clock usually in the morning on 4th of July in front of the Archives Building. They have the fife and drum with the three-cornered hats and the whole deal.
Right. Oh, wow.
Kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to be out of town on the 4th of July.
You are?
Yeah.
You're never in town on 4th of July.
Family wedding.
Oh, okay. So, quite a bit going on. Let's start out with the fact that the president was in Senegal this morning. He did a news conference, and he was asked by a reporter whether, in fact, he addressed the issue of the fact that homosexuality was criminalized in Senegal. Mm-hmm. And the president said, yes, he had. And then the president of Senegal spoke. And he said, in fact, they were not homophobic, that somebody was not going to lose their job because that they were gay. But the country was not ready to decriminalize it. And then he talked about the death penalty and said, well, other African countries had the death penalty. They were more evolved, but they were not evolved on homosexuality.
Well, just consider what Bill Clinton was saying just 15 years ago.
That's right.
I mean, to think that every country in the world is going to rocket forward at the same speed. You know, most of Europe is about a generation ahead of us.
Right.
I think, you know, most of Africa is about a generation behind us. But, you know, it's these things. And South America.
By the way, went to I went to the Veterans Affairs Department. This was their Gay Pride Week.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this all came in context. And they said that they are not ready yet to determine every law. And the president said that they have to go through every federal statute and see which federal statutes that they have to change, which you might have to issue executive orders, whatever, signing statements, kinds of things, even though it's not a signing statement, for each of those. But the Veterans Affairs Department has been ready for this, and they have been working on it. And, you know, whether it's that somebody gets veterans benefits or that they get student benefits or that their kids get benefits, it's all very interesting.
Yeah. It's not like the laws have to change, because where the word marriage or spouse appears, it simply now applies to...
Well, it's not so simple because, for instance, as I said yesterday with the IRS issue,
right,
if you file a joint return in a state where you're allowed to file a joint return, well, you're going to get the federal benefits. But what if a state like Texas or Tennessee does not have gay marriage and therefore they don't have you can't file a joint return, then what happens? Then you don't get that. It's kind of complicated.
You don't get the benefits in the state. So then you have...
No, but if you got married in Massachusetts and moved to Texas,
right,
you can still get Social Security and other benefits. It's
right,
the IRS.
You get the federal benefits.
That's
you
right,
can't get the state benefits, which sets up an Article 4. You know,
I think we'll see this again.
Challenge.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll see some interesting challenges on that front. Let's talk about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate did pass an immigration bill today. It was 68-32. The vice president was there and presiding over it. 14 Republicans went with the Democrats on this. I don't actually have a list. House Speaker John Boehner said this bill is not going to come up in the House.
Wow.
How do you just say that?
And this is a giant welfare program for Arizona and Texas, because they raised the number of border agents that they're going to give to them from 18,000 to 40,000. I mean, they're throwing billions of dollars into those states. Those states are going to have economies that are going to hum along just basically on having a Berlin Wall.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, the Berlin Wall created jobs. You know, right. I used to walk along that wall.
Yeah,
you
used
wall,
to have
you know?
Cops there and
oh,
whatever,
yeah,
whatever,
guys
right?
with dogs and guys with machine guns. They pointed their guns at me many, many times. I can tell you. I guarantee you they all had a decent salary and probably health care. Well, no, they did have health care. It was East.
By the way, there was public in the Senate gallery. They shouted, "Yes, we can," which, of course, you're not allowed to do from the Senate gallery, but they did today.
United States Senate. When right. the immigration bill passed.
That's right.
Wow.
Okay. So today, Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, he ran a bipartisan group saying that they do not believe in arming Syrian rebels. They're against the administration. Peter Welch of Vermont was there. Charles Gibson, Republican of New York. Rick Nolan, Democrat from Minnesota. Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina, were part of that bipartisan group. Kind of interesting on that. Also, let's go with the Department of Justice.
Hang on just a second, yes. if I may. Those people were all opposed to arming the Syrian rebels.
That's
They're
right.
not going to get their way, though, are they?
They're not going to get their way because the president's commander-in-chief.
Right.
I must say I'm very mixed about this issue.
Yeah.
I've been to Syria. It's a very complicated situation.
It's extremely complicated. And in my mind, the major complication is that it's a secular society. And
a very secular society.
Which has worked out well for minorities and for women.
Right. Christmas was a state holiday.
Right.
And I remember, I think I've told you, I went into the Syrian Museum. There's the most beautifully preserved synagogue from the year 750 or something like mm-hmm. that. And then you go in the bookstore and there's all this anti-Zionist literature.
Right.
I mean, it's a very mixed, complicated society.
Yeah.
Okay, federal grand jury returned a 30-count indictment against Sarnoff in Boston, the alleged
Joker Sarnoff, though, yeah.
The alleged bomber. Including the murder of police officer Sean Collier. So that was today's indictment. Absolutely happened.
Any story on what his condition is or where he is? Has he recovered?
He is
from
in a prison hospital in Devens, Massachusetts. Used to be called Fort Devens. I used to live about 4 miles from there.
Uh-huh.
I'll never forget one morning I'm sitting in the local diner and I see all these beautiful balloons going up. And about 5 minutes later, I see tanks going down the road, and I'm going, wait a minute, there's some disconnect here.
Fort Devens. Okay.
Yes.
We have to wrap it up.
Okay.
Ellen. So thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being with us. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Coming up next, Debbie Hines is going to be with us, the trial lawyer, former prosecutor, legal political commentator who has been keeping very, very close watch on what's going on in the George Zimmerman trial for his murder of Trayvon Martin. So we'll be back with that, and then we'll pick up your phone calls and continue rolling out of the show.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Debbie Hines, our trial lawyer, former prosecutor, legal political commentator, and our eyeballs on and ears on the Trayvon Martin murder, George Zimmerman on trial for murder trial. Debbie, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. So what happened today?
Well, finally, Rachel Gentile, who is the witness, well, what they're calling the stars, the state star witness, got off the witness stand after being on yesterday and today for a total of 5 hours for a cell phone conversation that lasted minutes with Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm. And what did she, I saw some of the testimony yesterday and some this morning, and I saw a headline about crackers today, too. What's the essence of all of this?
Well, we have to go back to what is the theme that the state is trying to prove, which is that Trayvon was profiled, he was pursued, and that he was killed for no reason other than George Zimmerman could kill him. So she adds, what she does is adds the pursuit aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she's on the phone and she's talking to Trayvon as he's being followed and, you know, he's saying that this blank cracker is following me, mm-hmm. And, you know, she's telling him to run. He's saying, well, no, I'm almost home. And they're just having back and forth conversations. She's saying, well, maybe it's a rapist. And he's like, no, don't say that. So she does establish that there's the pursuit. Now, with respect to the cracker comment, when the defense got a hold of her, Don West, he tries to turn it, which is what the defense is trying to do, is turn it into that Trayvon Martin was the one that had the racial animosity towards George Zimmerman by the use of that name.
And the cracker in the black community was like the use of the N-word in the white community.
Right.
And I don't know how that's going to fly down there.
She explained that. I mean, they asked her, and it's just a matter of whether people believe her. I mean, she said that in her world that that's not offensive. That's just a statement that he was saying. It's
In my world, that's not offensive.
Derogatory. And they just went back and forth on that about why she didn't say that in her conversation to his mother. And she says, well, I didn't want to say that to his mother, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, in my world, that's not offensive. I mean, if somebody called me a cracker, I'd look at them funny, like, what do you mean? But.
Right.
It's not the Caucasians have not been the oppressed race in this country.
Correct.
And there's a real different thing about having been the victims of genocide and slavery versus having been the people who were perpetrating it.
Correct.
And whatever labels are attached to that, well. I've said enough.
I don't think they got anywhere with that. But oh my God, the defense did spend a fair amount of time on the use of the word cracker.
Yeah, amazing. So one of the commentaries that I saw last night. In fact, it was I'll just lay it out. I was watching Anderson Cooper on CNN,
okay.
And he's got a defense lawyer on there and a couple of prosecution lawyers, and one of the defense lawyers pointed out, and I thought it was sort of in code, but I'll decode it, I think. He said, I don't think this witness is going to be that credible with this jury. And I took that to me, and then, you know, framed by the context of the conversation around it, I think that what he was saying is that you've got a jury that is mostly white and one Latino. There's no African Americans on the jury, and you've got an African American on the stand, and whether you claim that you're not racist or not, the fact of the matter is that everybody is racist at some deep level, not necessarily screaming racist, but
right.
you know, we've seen the reports, we've seen the studies. I took that test that Harvard right. came out with about 15 years ago, and I never thought there was any part of racism in me, and there's a racial preference there. Surprise, it's pretty much the case for everybody. So what are your thoughts on that, and is that a part of, do you think, the strategy of the defense in trying to...
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, go for
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That is definitely the strategy of the defense. I mean, what they're trying to do is to subtly get in racism to their advantage on the case. So, yes, they're going to, you know, in closing, they're going to basically use how she looked and how she came across in terms of arguing the credibility, but those are the subtle nuances of racism. They've also tried to twist the fact that, you know, that the cracker aspect, that it was really Trayvon who was the racist one in this regard, and it wasn't George Zimmerman who was the one who's made all these phone calls to the police complaining about African Americans looking suspicious in his neighborhood, which has already come out earlier in the week. So yes, they're going to try to, you know, twist it around. They've already tried to twist it subtly around in opening by saying that it was Trayvon Martin who had taken all these fighting courses, and he was really the, you know, like the teenage black Incredible Hulk, where George Zimmerman just wasn't that athletic.
Oh. Seriously, I missed that. I didn't.
Yes, they in opening, Don West talked about how Trayvon was, you know, took some fighting courses. I don't know if there was exact wording when right. he was describing the size of Trayvon Martin versus George Zimmerman, and he goes into detail about how George Zimmerman, you know, was in the gym and had lost weight before because apparently he was heavy, like not as heavy as he is now, but he was heavier before, lost weight, but he was just told he just was not that, you know, physically, you know, athletic.
Right. Do you think that there's any? I mean, George Zimmerman has gained 100 pounds since he killed Trayvon Martin.
Right.
Do you think that that is, you know, like a guy who's depressed and scared and eating too much? Or do you think that that's like the defense said, you know, if you really look like somebody who's not at all physically fit, they're more likely to believe that you got beat up by a guy who was?
I've heard that. I don't think that he gained the weight as a part of a trial strategy. I mean, because he's not sympathetic looking that heavy. We all, as we have race issues with people with race and ethnicity, you know, we have to be real. We also have issues with people who are heavy and overweight.
Right.
So I don't think that that would have been a strategy for him to gain weight. He might have could have gained a little weight if they didn't want him to look like he was in shape, but his attorney's saying he gained 110, 125 pounds in a year. I just think that was stress.
Yeah, I suspect so too. So what's your sense of where the two, you know, to kind of horse race this, which is, I hate to take it to the simple denominator, but I'm curious. I can't, you know, who seems to be ahead here? Who's doing well? Is the defense or the prosecution, and why?
Well, at this stage, it would be the prosecution, and it's only because they're in control of the situation. This is their side of the case, and you always have to be reminded that we've only heard really their side, although the defense has been able to cross-examine the witnesses. They haven't had their day up at bat. So at this point, yes, it does favor the prosecution. It's still a tight case, and I've always said a circumstantial case is never a slam dunk. It's a very difficult case to prove, but we're only really hearing this side, and the defense hasn't been able to make that many inroads in with the witnesses. They've made obviously some points, but I don't think they've made a lot of points that go to the germane issues of profile, pursuit, and killing because you could.
Right. We have a little less than a minute, Debbie. The defense has witnesses, presumably. Have they published the list?
Oh, yes. What you do is everybody publishes voluminous lists, so there's no way to know who they're actually going to put on. I mean, everybody's published like about over 100 possible witnesses that they could come up with.
Does anything on that list pop out at you?
As testify until they actually take the witness stand.
Does anybody on that list pop out to you as, this could be a problem?
No, I mean, I think that you pretty much know who the witnesses were going to be because of the 911 calling.
Right.
And so because of the transcript. So I don't think there are going to be any surprises in that regard. I'd be surprised if George Zimmerman takes the stand.
Yeah, I think everybody would. Okay, Debbie Hines, a trial lawyer, former prosecutor, political legal commentator over at LegalSpeaks.com. You can read Debbie's work over at LegalSpeaks.com. Debbie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Great talk.
Always great talking with you, too. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. If you've been watching the trial and you have a strong opinion about it, I'd be curious to get your take on it. Or we can go back to talking about Reagan and sick leave. Hey, it's Thursday. The 1 minute of the one day of the week where Louise and Sean say, yes, you can have 3 minutes to talk about science. Geeky science. Let's get geeky on living and breathing oceans. Scientists have long known that oxygen circulates through our oceans and that it allows our oceans to breathe as levels of the gas dip up and down. But now scientists have discovered that deep sea creatures that come to the surface of the ocean at night to feed have a major impact on levels of oxygen in the ocean. Since there's little to no food at the bottom of the ocean, deep sea creatures rise to the surface at night to eat. And they then head back to the deep depths of the ocean. And according to scientists, it's through this process that the creatures consume large amounts of oxygen from what is commonly referred to as the oxygen minimum zone. Since the number of animals that live in the deep depths of the ocean is quite large, scientists knew that their oxygen consumption would probably be pretty large, too. To determine just how much oxygen was being consumed, they produced a global model of oxygen depletion and a model of the migrations of deep-sea creatures. They also used acoustic ocean data collected between 1990 and 2011 to see how many animals are doing this elevator ride up and down in the depths of the ocean. After analyzing all the data, they found that global consumption of oxygen is about 10 to 40% of the total amount of oxygen at the deepest depths of the ocean. Scientists also found that the deepest depths of the ocean can barely replenish the amount of oxygen consumed during the migrations of the deep sea creatures. Daniel Bianchi, a postdoc researcher at McGill University and a member of the research team, said in a press release that if the ocean changes, then the depths of these migrations will also change. We can expect potential changes in the interaction between larger guys and little guys. What complicates this story is that if these animals are responsible for a chunk of oxygen depletion in general, then a change in their habits might have a feedback in terms of oxygen levels in other parts of the deeper ocean. Let me translate that into English. As the animals are moving up and down the elevator trying to get oxygen, if the oxygen levels in the ocean change as a result of global warming, their behavior going up and down the elevator, or maybe even their ability to survive, might be affected, will be affected. The bottom line here is that the findings of this study are crucial to understand more about the deep sea habitat and the role that deep sea creatures play in the ocean environment as a whole. Yeah. Okay. Anne, listening to KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Anne, what's on your mind today?
Hey. It's nice to talk to you, Tom. I've actually met you one time when you were here doing a book thing.
Oh, well, nice. Thank you. Nice to hear your nice to meet you again.
Well, and we're sort of past this, the whole business about sick employees, but my husband and I were small business owners here in Albuquerque, and one of the things that he was adamant about was that we provide a decent pay and benefits for our employees. Mm-hmm. And so they earned a vacation, so they earned paid vacation time, mm-hmm. and we gave them health insurance and sick leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to change the policy at one point because we had a former employee who shall be nameless, who after he handed in his notice, he was going on somewhere else. He suddenly got sick, and he kept calling in sick until he'd used up all his sick leave in the 2 weeks of notice that he gave before he moved on to his next job.
Oh, isn't that special?
And wasn't that nice?
Yeah.
So we actually had a policy that we named after him, that if you gave in your notice, then you lost your sick leave. Because we had given them the sick leave,
yeah,
and therefore, if they were leaving, they didn't need it.
Well, and you could
nobody,
flip that logic.
None of the other employees complained about that as a policy because they're all still there. Many of them have been there for 20 years.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Although you could flip the logic of that upside down and say that they actually were earning the sick leave as well by virtue of the fact that they were helping you make the business work. But I understand your logic.
Also paying the majority of the insurance that covered them.
Right.
And one of our employees who was young and healthy one time said, I don't know why we're paying all this money to cover this health insurance, until one time he got really sick.
Mm.
He came back and he was like, oh, my gosh, I am so glad you do this.
Yeah, there you go.
But no, my husband was, he was adamant that we take care of our employees.
Yeah.
But we didn't like having them take advantage of us, and it only happened that one time.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, Ann, thank you for sharing that story. It's one of those kind of things that provokes thought and conversation. Jim in Yarnell, Arizona. Hey, Jim, what's up? Jim?
Hi, Tom.
Hey. No speakerphone, please.
Yeah, I'm working on it. There we go. Do you hear me?
No, I don't think so.
Are you there?
Yes.
Are you there?
I am here. Are you there?
Are you there?
I am here. Jim?
Tom, are you there?
I'm here. Are you? Can you hear me, Jim?
Oh, finally.
Okay,
my
good.
My goodness, yes.
Good.
What a trial and tribulation.
Indeed. We have a minute till the break, Jim. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say that Ronald Reagan was one of the largest or the biggest betrayers of the American dream that anybody could ever imagine, and I'm amazed at how he's still worshipped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but he came in on with the agreement with the Iranians to free the hostages after his election, right?
That's correct.
Right there, he had already made a deal that should have disqualified him as being an elected official, period.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And again, I don't understand why this is not front page headlines all across America, that just a few weeks ago, or maybe a couple of months ago at the most, the president the former president of Iran, who was elected president, Mr. Bonnie Sauter, was elected president during 1980 on a platform of I'm going to free the hostages. After he was elected, went to the mullahs and said, okay, here it is, July of 1980, I want to free the hostages now, and or September or whatever the month was. And the mullahs said, no, you can't do that. We cut a deal with the Reagan campaign, and we have to keep them at least until after the election. And so he was stuck with it because the mullahs held the power. And he wrote that for the Christian Science Monitor. You can find it on the web.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It should have been a headline in the New York Times. It should have been a headline in the Christian Science Monitor. Like, arguably it was. The bad and the very, very Nola Matangeritarianly ugly. Brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain at edisonfactor.com. The good, Barbara Nelson. Immediately after the Supreme Court announced its decision striking down the Defense of Marriage Act yesterday morning, the New York immigration judge halted the planned deportation of Colombian national Stephen Brooks. Until yesterday's ruling, the federal government couldn't officially acknowledge Stephen's marriage to his partner, Sean, so he was unable to get residency like many straight partners of U.S. citizens can. If Judge Nelson hadn't responded so quickly to the Supreme Court's ruling, Sean's deportation proceedings would have started promptly at 10:30 in the morning. Now he and his husband can live happily ever after, together, in the U.S. Good work, Judge Nelson, and congratulations to the happy couple. The bad. Neil Cavuto. Even though we now know that the IRS scandal was nothing but a creation of Daryl Grand Theft Auto ICE's cynical mind, Fox Business host Neil Cavuto still wants to blame the White House.
You know, I'm wondering about the words that apparently did come up in this database search or whatever it was, included Occupy, included groups with that type of terminology. You know, these groups were not friendly to President Obama. So cynically, I could say that they did indeed target groups that were not, let's say, pro-White House.
Correct.
Just give it a rest, Neil. You may not like the IRS, but it's pretty clear by now the agents were just doing their jobs. But maybe, just maybe, if you try hard enough, you'll wish your scandal true. And the very, very ugly, Zombie Industries. The California-based company is already notorious for selling an ex-girlfriend zombie gun target at last month's NRA convention in Houston, Texas. Its two newest products won't do anything to help its reputation, however. The gun control lobbyist, whose name doesn't need much explaining, is advertised as just begging to be put down, while the AI zombie shown on the right is supposed to represent MSNBC talk show host Al Sharpton? Really? Both are available for purchase on the company's website. You'd think Zombie Industries would have shuttered its doors after the heat it got for selling the ex-girlfriend target, but apparently not. It's bad enough that the company sold its hateful products in the first place, but the fact that it continues to have a market for them, even after being roundly criticized by the general public, well, that's just very, very ugly. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. You don't think it was all Ronald Reagan?
No. How you doing, Mr. Hartman? I actually want to disagree with you for the first time.
Okay.
We all know that when an administration comes into power, which is Ronald Reagan, he's got people around him who control the shots up to a point. Mm-hmm. What was the first thing that they almost did to Ronald Reagan? Well, not they, but whatever. But John Hinckley Jr. tried to kill him. Right. Do you think that George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the vice president, and if the assassination attempt had been successful, George Herbert Walker Bush would have been president? What are your thoughts?
The coincidences were pretty mind-boggling. Wasn't George Bush having dinner with Hinckley's dad?
I don't know.
At that time? I mean, there was some connection between... Maybe not. I genuinely don't know, Michael. I have not paid that much attention to that moment in history. So I don't, you know, I don't have a conspiracy theory to offer. I'm willing to take it on its face that Hinckley was just, you know, infatuated with Jody, what's her name?
Jody Foster.
Jody Foster, yeah, thank you. And that, you know, he thought that this was the way to get his sweetheart's love or whatever.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the call, Michael. Oop, excuse me. Hey, Gary, in Granite City, Illinois. You're on the air, Gary. What's up?
Oh, finally glad to get through, Tom. I've been trying for some time on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But you there?
I am. You are too.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, you know, all this Republican nonsense, you know, about the Europeans paying more taxes than we do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced they don't. Ask these brain dead Republicans, say, hey, stupid Republican, look at your paycheck stub.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I take the difference between my gross pay and my net pay, I'm coming up with 30%.
Right.
Well, what is this 30%, Tom? It's, well, let's see, federal income tax, Social Security tax, state income tax, unemployment tax.
Right.
You know, they don't pay more taxes than we do.
Yeah, they do.
There's no way.
Yeah, they do. The average tax rate for middle-class workers in Denmark is a little over 50%.
Yeah, but the minimum wagers pay 24%, which is $15 an hour. I'm making $18 an hour, and I'm paying 30%.
Yeah, they have higher wages in those countries, but the other thing is that you're paying 30% in taxes, and you're probably paying another 10 or 15% for health care, whether you're paying for it yourself or whether your employer is paying for it. If your employer is paying for it, you're probably paying for it in the form of a diminished payroll. And in countries that have national health care systems, A, that costs half as much, so the taxes are lower than what we're paying, if you consider the cost of health care to be a tax. And B, that's a piece of the taxes that people are perfectly willing to pay because they know that they're getting something of value for it. So I think the concern in America is not that people don't want to pay taxes. I think it's that people don't feel like they're getting their money's worth for their taxes. They see this huge military-industrial complex, and they see us, you know, with military bases and wars all over the world, and they're going, "I'm paying to support that," and they, you know, and it's just it doesn't, but I can't get health care, you know, but we're going to provide health care to people in other countries, and it just at a certain point, people just figure, yeah, it doesn't work. Gary, thanks for the call. Chuck in Redondo Beach, California. You wanted to talk about Larry Beinhart?
Yeah, I know you mostly agree with him, but I just read his stuff again, and I noticed that the thing that you say, the Kennedy Johnson tax cuts, they hurt the economy. I mean, Reagan killed it, but they hurt it. And the main thing, the main concern I have is when you say that the Johnson JFK tax cuts, they balanced it. They made up of the revenue neutral thing, but the revenue neutral is a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. What we want is people to reinvest in their business, and you agree with all that. And so when you make even the Kennedy Johnson tax cuts hurt the economy, and
may well be.
And we
may well be. I'm not sure that I had to go back and read Larry's stuff. Larry Beinhart, for the benefit of people who don't know what we're talking about, is a writer out in Los Angeles who did an analysis of the United States economic condition over the last century and found that whenever tax rates were above 50% and the LBJ Kennedy tax cut dropped the top tax rate from 95% down to 74%, so it was still above 50%, that whenever the top tax rate was above 50%, the economy steadily grew and there were not bubbles and there were not crashes. And that whenever the top tax rate dropped below 50%, as it did in the 20s and as it did again in the 80s, that you then entered a phase of bubble boom, or bubble bust, as a consequence of wealthy people having basically too much cheap money to play with. And so they went for high-stakes gambling rather than cautious gambling. And, you know, that's his hypothesis.
Right. But and of course, I agree with you on all that. But the continuation is, even when that Johnson JFK cuts went into effect, it slowed the economy. It continued to grow.
Yeah.
It slowed that growth. So
yeah.
I just wanted to point that out to read it. But the real concern is like when Robbie Batra was on, he told you that when the deficit gets small, that the market crashes.
And that also bad for the economy, because that's one of his metrics that he measures the economy with.
Yes. So, well, and that's what the modern money theory people, the MMT people, are talking about, is that, you know, our deficit equals the public debt equals private savings. And that when you, yeah, exactly, when you diminish your debt rapidly, that you set up a crash, because you're also rapidly decreasing public savings.
Right.
And that's not a good thing.
In addition, even if you had the deficit, when it's, you're reinvesting, that's all.
Right.
So you want a big debt, and especially now, you want a huge deficit, but
during
cutting it in half, it's going to kill us.
I don't disagree, and which is why my next book is titled The Crash of 2016. I don't disagree, Chuck. Thanks a lot for the call. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. We got a minute to the break. Steve, what's up?
Yeah, in Occoquan Reservoir, they have a liquid oxygen tank that they use common soaker hose and went up the reservoir and oxygenate the water.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually gets all the particulates to fall out of the water and the pollution and everything, so the water is pretty much clean when it goes into the pipes to be treated.
Right.
The only problem is, in about 5 years, the catfish are going to be sticking their heads out of the water going, meow.
we're driving evolution? Is that your theory? But, you know, yes, oxygen, I mean, you know, things burn, basically, or metabolize as a consequence of exposure to oxygen. It's called oxidation. And so and high levels of oxygen can actually act as a disinfectant, you know, kills off anaerobic things. And it even kills things that live on oxygen, you know, too high a level. So, interesting point. Thank you for the call, Steve. We'll be back. Actually, a big surprise for you. I've got to do a pre-tape, and so Shano and Danielle are going to be dancing for a little bit here. So stick around. They'll be back for the last 10 minutes of the show. And I will see you tomorrow.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Danielle and Shano also do a show out of the studio on the weekends. They'll tell you all about that, too.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Shano and Danielle sitting in just for the last segment here. Do not worry. Tom will be back tomorrow for Brunch with Bernie. How you doing, Danielle?
I'm doing great. Yes, they are letting the kids play in the adult studio.
Yes, just for one quick segment here. But we're going to continue taking your calls. And, of course, Danielle, you have control of the phones there, so I'll let you.
I do, and I've never controlled this one, so we're going to go with Paul in Green. Let's see here. How do we get Paul?
Florida.
Oh, there you are, Paul. Paul, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, thank you. Basically, I have a question regarding, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, how can anyone get excited over this immigration bill that was just passed in the Senate when everyone knows that this thing doesn't have a prayer of going anywhere in the House? I mean, I heard this John Boehner interviewed, and he said words to the effect that I wish you guys would stop trying to make me answer this political football, because I have to go back and talk to my constituents and caucus with my members, and we haven't made a decision on anything.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he wants to go back and talk to his Tea Party members about anything.
It doesn't seem his constituents are really the problem. It's more the Tea Party members, and he has officially said that he's not going to take the bill that the Senate just passed and put that in front of the House, that they're going to start all over. In fact, I saw an interview last night with Paul Ryan, who said they're going to do it their own special way, which I know everyone knows is incredibly special. So it's going to be a completely different bill. And Republicans on top of it are going to be really worried about just sending anything, because they're worried that somehow in conference they're going to lose all of their walls and their border security agents, et cetera.
Right.
So the
immigration bill in general, I don't know why anybody would be excited about it, because there's so many awful provisions in this bill. It's essentially turning our border into the next Berlin Wall, because Democrats want to pass something. They want to have the victory under their belt. And I just don't know that it's worth giving up so many things in the name of comprehensive immigration reform when you're not actually getting comprehensive immigration reform. What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, no, I agree with what you just said, but I think the thing that's so frustrating to me is that my perception is that a small minority of the Republican Party in the House, which is the core Tea Party, basically is controlling anything that gets done in this country right now.
Exactly, and what they're doing is they realize that Democrats, more than anything, would very, very much like to fix our immigration system, that we really want to get something done. We want a path to citizenship. We want to reunite families who've been torn apart by this and have workers here who've been working and contributing to our society actually be able to come out of the shadows. And they are willing, because they don't care, they are scorched earth, they are willing to extort as much as of their agenda as they possibly can from us in order for us to get that, what I think is noble goal, a noble goal. The question is, how much of that will we give up in the process? And at what point do we say, that's too much? That's too much. So we have to see how it plays out.
Yep. But, Paul, I completely understand. And, you know, it is something that you have to be questionable about getting excited about. But thank you very much for the call. And we'll go to Charlotte in New Mexico. Charlotte, thanks for joining us. You said you had a comment about Reagan.
I sure do. And I have never heard anybody say this before in all the years. Ronald Reagan supplied arms to Iran. Iran is our enemy. Section 3 of Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution says that giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States is treason. And I've never heard that word used except from me. So tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, actually,
Ronald Reagan committed treason.
Tom has talked about that quite a bit. In fact, as part of the October surprise, which he was speaking about before the break, when Reagan's campaign staff negotiated with the Iranians for them to hold on to the hostages until after his election, part of that was, if you hold on to them, I will give you arms. I will give you repair parts for your military, because they had American hardware and they needed American parts. So, yes, he did supply Iran, and something that Tom does talk about, but I'm glad that you pointed out yet again, because it's something we should remind everyone of, because Republicans like to talk about the lore of Reagan and forget about all the things he actually did.
Right.
No, that the Bible and the birthday cake, all treason. All treason.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Charlotte. Let's see. Wilford, I know Wilford is a regular caller, and he always has such great intent. Wilford, I know you are very adamant about this point. Why don't you remind everybody again about what they should be focusing on? Wilford, in Bloomington, Indiana?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Wilford, this is Danielle. You've called the Tom Harbin program. I'm not answering the phones right now.
We're on the air.
Yeah, we're on the air. You like to remind everybody?
Well, I just want to know why... I know President Obama's got a large plate, but I just wonder why he doesn't do anything about Ron Siegelman.
About Don Siegelman, right. Well, Wilford, I know you call about that a lot, and I admire you for sticking to it very much.
Free-don.com.
Free-don.com, everybody.
And Tom does mention that nearly every single day.
Yes.
Every single day. And he tells the story. I think he told the story actually earlier in the show.
Yeah, it is very important. And he is, you know, a political prisoner. And more people should be calling, asking the president to pardon him and get him out of jail. It's about time.
It is indeed. Probably time for one more quick
call.
One more quick call.
All right. We have Susan.
Oh, maybe not. Oh, see, this is different. It's a lot different actually being on the board and hosting at the same time. I looked up at the clock and I see we have about 10 more seconds.
Okay, Susan, well, I apologize.
Tomorrow.
We'll have to get you in tomorrow. But Susan was saying that they were just requesting more funds in Louisiana to clean up the BP oil spill. So it's still going on.
Yes, it is.
All these years later, and we should still be talking about it. This has been the Tom Hartman Program. Shane and Danielle here. Tom will be back tomorrow with Bernie Sanders, America's Senator, for Brunch with Bernie. So get your calls ready, and he'll be back tomorrow.
And remember, this is not a spectator story. Get active. Get out there. Do something. And we will be back tomorrow with Tom and Senator Sanders.
Thank you.
See you then. Bye-bye.
You've been
listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.